Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
In this episode of No Holds Barred, we talk to Nikita, who is a 28-year-old woman who has worked in the sex industry for 10 years. Now recently retired from sex work, we chat about how her experience have influenced the way she feels about the world and the people that inhabit it, how she copes with things that have happened to her, and offers some practical advice for men who insist on having objects put up their bum. This is Nikita. This is her story. Nikita, all I know about you is you're 28 now, you're Indian, and now I know that you've lived most of your life in London and part of it in Hackney, and also know that you got into the adult industry when you was 18.
Yes, yeah.
That's all right?
That's all correct, yeah.
Good. I guess the best place for me to start is there. Girls get into the adult industry at a young age, of often it seems to be kind of a stereotype with that industry, but being Indian isn't. Were you aware of that? What was that like?
My family background is like we're Kenyan Indians who kind of had to leave Kenya in the 70s for a bunch of different reasons. And I grew up, the community that they moved to in Leicester is all very close-knit, and my sort of like my mum and us didn't like it very much, so we moved to London. And I think that's a part of like maybe why I have a slightly different upbringing to other British Indians, where we actively moved away from our like diaspora community here. So it was maybe like a less traditional British Indian upbringing, where we're basically like, for all intents and purposes, we're like a coconut family. Right. But my mum just had a Jubilee party and was it was the highlight of her year, I think. But there is a less traditional background, I think I've got.
Right, because obviously you probably anticipated that was what I was going to ask you, in that my understanding of an Indian household is not one that would lead to the career path that you chose from a young age. What was your household like? And when you say Kenyan Indian, so can you explain that to me? How does that come about? Was there a big population of Indians in Kenya?
Yeah, there was. So back here, colonial times, when there are different types of Indian communities in Kenya or in East Africa, but for mine, it was kind of a choice between, there's no food here, but you can take a boat down to East Africa and build train tracks and there'll be food there. So my family made that choice over 100 years ago. And then when Kenya was decolonizing, there was like Idi Amin next door. And I think it's just like, it's like such a contentious thing to talk about, so I'm going to try and just be like neutral about it. But in the process of decolonization, there was a perspective that the Indian migrants living in East Africa were propping up the British, so they had to go. And it was, some people call like East African Indians in the UK like refugees. Like, I think it gets referred to Priti Patel's family a lot. I like referred to as refugees, but it's like complex, and I wouldn't say they're like typical refugees. But yeah, so that's, they ended up in the East Midlands, and then we ended up in London. My sort of family itself, there wasn't like a big, like, I know, there's usually a few generations under one roof and like a patriarch. Yeah. And we had neither because my dad passed away. So it was sort of a single mum, three kids, wow. And less traditional than other British Indian families.
Was there a religious aspect to you? Was there a religious aspect to your upbringing at all, or would you?
No, my dad was very, very not religious. But my extended family, so we'd spend summers because my mum's a nurse, so she'd be working nights, and she'd be doing it on the trot over the summer to try and like make money. Mm. So we'd go up to Leicester, and there was lots of religious stuff there, but my mum isn't. And I actually came back to, I was like a diehard, like Richard Dawkins or atheist when I was a teenager.
Yeah.
But I've come in my like mid-20s while I was doing the sex work, I did come back to religion in quite a big way. And I would like, I'd say I'm a religious person now.
Wow. So religious in conventional sense or spiritual?
Do
you align yourself to a specific religion?
Yeah, I'm Hindu. Like I know I'm Hindu purely because it was a religion I grew up with. But I don't really. I mean, up in the northeast, there aren't many temples here. I think I'd have to travel quite a while to find my nearest mandir. But I mean, I practice. I pray and I follow religious convention generally. I don't think you can follow many religious conventions like to the T, living in like the UK in 2022. But like, I follow the rules that, like, I think are good because, you know, like every religion, it's all its problematic aspects. But yeah, like I think I'm sort of a average religious person in current times.
It's funny you mentioned Richard Dawkins because I remember going through a phase like that. I'm 40, but I remember his book coming out and reading it and being impressed by it. But the older I've got, the less impressed I am with him and his ideas of about religion I feel like he's sometimes severe in his thoughts and opinions as the people that he's chastising or criticizing.
Yeah, like you could probably say there's like a difference in the harm, I guess, that's being created or formed by people like. Organized religion is responsible for like a huge amount of harm to people, and maybe Richard Dawkins less so, but he is he's as dogmatic in his beliefs as the people he's criticizing. Absolutely. I guess yeah
for sure. Okay, so your dad passed away and was you very young? Do you remember him?
I was 13. I mean, that was he spent some of my childhood in prison, so it was about after the age of 10 he wasn't super present.
What did he do? What do you not want
to
say?
Well, no, I mean, I was going to have to say a racial slur, but I could just like not say the slur. But so he, in his words, also he was a bullshitter, so I don't know if this is true or not. But in his words, someone called him a fat P word, so he jumped on their head. But you don't, with him, you just don't know if it's true or not. So he may or may not have gone to prison for that reason.
Right, so he wasn't sure about the... The truth. So what, did he pass away in prison?
No, he I don't think he was out for very long before he died. He just he was an addict, and that he did, so it just messed his body up basically.
Yeah fair enough. That must have been very difficult as a 13-year-old. You're super aware, like even all of that stuff. I know you said that he was in prison, he wasn't around a lot, but it must have been quite difficult when I guess most of the people, certainly in if you're becoming an adult at 13, to not have that in your life must have been relatively difficult. Or did you, some young people just ride the wave and they're cool and they're resilient. Others aren't. Where did you feel?
Yeah. I think I was kind of going in that direction anyway, but I left full-time education. I was like drinking a lot. I was doing like anything my little 13-year-old had to get my hands on.
So you dropped out of school?
Yeah. Well, I was still in school. I just didn't go. And it ended up in me having to like resit a year because I was too young to drop out because I didn't get GCSEs. And then I managed to like just about get GCSEs in the year I had to redo at like a different college. Mm. And then I ended up getting A-levels, but I had something like 40% attendance and they weren't very good A-levels. But I like, it was, you know, just, I think back then you had to be in school until you were 18, otherwise your parents will get in trouble, I think.
Yeah, so you was just kind of doing enough to
yeah, okay, to stop my mum getting fined, basically.
Yeah, I get it. So, I kind of felt like that. My entire experience going through school was I just need to do enough to get through this so I just can get out into the world.
Yes, yeah. But yeah, so that kind of kept me occupied until I was 18. And then left school, knew I wasn't going to uni. I think we're still pretty much in the depths of like the last recession. Was trying to find jobs, had no job experience. So it was like trying to find like waitressing or bar work, but because I never worked before, wasn't getting the jobs.
Yeah.
The only job I managed to get was like being a charity mugger for like £4.98 an hour.
So these are the people on the streets, for people that are American listeners, whether there are many of them. So these are people on the streets that are employed by a charity to try and get you to sign up for donations or to just go on a mailing list and then you're harangued via your phone constantly to try and sign up.
Yes. Horrible, horrible job.
Yeah, that must have been tough.
Yeah.
Because no one wants to speak to you. Even if it's a very good cause, you don't want to be stopped by it, no matter how good the cause. You just don't want to be stopped during the day.
Yeah, people have stuff to do, and also you don't get anything out of it. Like, it's not like we're giving you anything. It's not your money, we just ask you to give money for a month. Mm. And yeah, I don't blame people for being like a bit aggressive or mean, but it did the first day I used to like shave my eyebrows off and draw them on. And I think I was like crying at about lunchtime, wiped the tear away, and I must have wiped pretty high up because I went to meet my boyfriend at the time after, and he was like, "You have one eyebrow."
You say you was crying. Is it just because of the stick you got from people?
Yeah, it was just horrible.
Oh my god, I knew it would be difficult and awkward, but I didn't think, what was it?
I cry. Everything makes me cry. It's right, like, right. It was, okay. Yeah.
I don't think I could do it. Even now, as a 40-year-old, I don't think I could go out there and hold a clipboard and try and get people to stop. Certainly not. How old were you then? Like, so you were 17, 18 then? So no,
I was 18 then, yeah. Like, and it's all commission-based as well. So the workers are like desperate as well because you're not getting paid very much otherwise.
Yeah.
But yeah, so I did that for a bit. And then sort of concurrently had ended up breaking up with that boyfriend who I just mentioned with the eyebrow thing.
Yeah.
And
why did you shave your eyebrows off?
I thought I would look better with like little McDonald's arches, but I kind of look like being the merciless.
Is that a common thing for the girls at your age at the time to do that? To shave them off? Or just you?
I don't think it was that common. I had like a quite specific, like I grew up as like a goth.
So right.
That was kind of part of a quite specific like aesthetic look I was doing,
right,
and I was like covered in piercings and yeah. But yeah, so the going into sex work, I had got I guess maybe some background. Like I, from the age of, I don't know, 13 until 16, I thought I was a lesbian, and then I met this boyfriend who was a lot older, and then was with him till I was 18, and then sort of after that ended, I was like, okay, I'm just going to go, like, explore my sexuality, I guess. Mm. And then maybe took that slightly too far. And then the sort of the next, for me, logical step was...
What, sorry, what do you mean you went too far? You just put yourselves in situations that you shouldn't
no,
have
done? No, I mean, I was just, like, I was, like, online dating and, like, going on, like, 3 dates a week.
Oh, okay.
And just, like, doing that for, like, a while. And then me being like, an 18-year-old genius, I was like, why don't I just get paid for this? So I got sacked from my charity mugging job and didn't know how to do it because I never met a sex worker before. I think right now with like OnlyFans and stuff, it's like quite ubiquitous that you'll probably know someone who is doing it. But right. I just didn't. So well, on Craigslist.
Different world. So you would use Craigslist?
Yeah.
Okay, sorry, I'm going to have to explain. So Craigslist was like... it was a... How would you describe it? It was essentially a list people listing like things
like
they want to sell.
Yeah,
exactly like that. Gumtree. And there would be a section on Craigslist, I'm presuming, for people to... What was it? How would you...
So I think they'd actually gotten rid of the adult services bit by the time I got onto it, but Craigslist was notorious for, you know, you get your hooker off Craigslist. But they had gotten rid of it. So you would use the personal section. And I also used the job seeking section. And I wasn't very discreet about it. I was like, I'm a cute 18-year-old. I will do a lot of things for money. And people kind of got the gist. But I remember I was like really naive when I started. I was using my email address that was like my full legal name.
Oh, wow.
Like I was really just, I wasn't thinking a lot. And yeah, like some of these situations I got myself into, I'm really lucky were not like really dangerous. Yeah. Like some bad things, obviously. Before
we get into those things, well, not into them, because I don't want to dig down into something that's, this isn't about titillation or anything like that. I'm not interested in that. But I am interested in how an 18-year-old girl makes that jump. How did you reconcile that in your brain, or was there no reconciliation? You just think, like you said, I'm doing this anyway for fun. Why not? What difference would it make?
There wasn't a real like thinking about. I almost didn't even think of it as like labor or a job. I was obviously doing it for money, and I knew I needed it for money. But I just didn't think about this, like, my position as a worker in this whole situation. It was just something I did. I remember, like, I was, like, completely skint the first booking, and I had to go from, like, Northwest, like Brent Harrow to Oxford Circus. And, like, I still had my student Oyster card, so it was, like, busing it down there. And was like jittery the whole way, because I was like, I can't believe I'm doing this.
So you were getting a bus to your first, what would you call them, punter?
Yeah, punter, booking, whatever, trick. But yeah, I just remember like being like, oh my God, I can't believe I'm doing this. But I mean, I think I probably got myself into more dangerous situations like off OkCupid. So I guess it didn't. And also I think I was like, long relationship had broken up, or longish for a 16, 18-year-old, and was just like, not, maybe there was a bit of like going a bit off the rails because of that. Very soon got into porn off the back of the Craigslist ads, because a porn company who I know I'm absolutely certain were just like a money laundering operation, got in touch, and like I did a solo photo and video shoot. And I was like, oh, this is fine. Yeah. And they told me how to get involved, like, or how I would be, you know, where to put my portfolio up to get more modeling jobs. And it just sort of was just like that. And then I only did the porn and the modeling until, I think I did that for 3 years in total, and then quit and just kept escorting.
What so just to take you back somewhat, how long did it take for it to become normal in inverted commas, from the point of that girl being on a tube using an Oyster card from college, traveling from Brent or wherever you said, where did you say Brent?
Yeah, like Brent Howard border.
Brent Howard border, right? To central London and Oxford Circus, and going through that first experience to it becoming normalized and not jittery, and you're not anxious about what you're about to do.
The anxiety would kind of come in waves. Because there'd be times where I'd like, I'm like an anxious person anyway, but like, you know, I'd be like, it would feel like I was on autopilot sometimes. And then I remember the last time I did, like, this would be 10 years into working. 9 years into working. I like would, what I would end up doing for money generally was just like book a hotel for 2 days, see clients at the hotel. And sometimes I'd be on like autopilot. But I remember the last time, I think maybe because of COVID, and it was like just before lockdown, I was like scared and jittery about it. And it was like, in, you know, interesting in my own head that like I'd been doing this completely nonstop. I'd taken 1 month off and like the entire time I was working. And I could still get like anxious about it.
So you're, so the answer is never, it never, never was really normal. It always felt.
You kind of always know that like you're putting yourself in like a dangerous situation. Especially like, you know, every so often there would be a story of like, you know, a worker getting hurt or even killed. And then you're like, oh, like this is what I do, I guess. But yeah, actually to try and answer like your question properly, I think within a few weeks, I just sort of got into grips with what I was doing at the beginning. The photo shoots, I think, took me a little longer to get used to, but it sort of felt, I think within a few months, it just felt like, this is my job, this is what I'm doing.
How much demand is there? Would you think the normal person, like I'm asking you, do you think I'd be surprised by the amount of men that were readily contacting you?
Oh yeah, like you, I have absolutely no doubt that you will have men in your life who pay for sex.
Well, so it's very common, and but people don't talk about it necessarily, but they go out and. Really?
You think about just how many clients there are, or if, like, I'm not traditionally attractive. I'm like, I think you'd have to be like specifically looking for someone like me in order to like book me. And I would get, my phone would be ringing nonstop, and I'd be like having, I'd be traveling around the country as well working. Like, if someone maybe like me who was getting that much demand, I'm trying to imagine, like, you know, what more traditionally attractive workers would be getting, and the range of clients as well. Like, I think over my career, I definitely saw over 2,000. Like, there's just too many. Like, when you think about it, in terms of like, that's one person having that many, and obviously clients see different workers or whatever. It's not like one worker of 2,000 or whatever, but like, there are just so many.
Yeah.
And I don't trust any of the figures when people do like try to make stats out of it, because if you look at the methodology, it's always so like whack and weird and done by people who don't understand the industry. So I wouldn't be able to like, you know, pluck a figure out the air and say this amount of men do. But
you could imagine it's a lot. Yeah, no. And also, how open are people about their activities as well? Do you know what I mean? It's not to get an accurate figure. It's you have to talk to one. I guess you'd go to a number of sex workers and you'd figure out how many people they've visited. But the punters or the clients are, they could be seeing multiple. So the figure is not.
Yeah.
It's never. You can never get a line under it. Really, it will always shifting depending on who you're speaking to.
Yeah. Exactly.
On a personal level, did you develop any personal friendships or actual genuine connections with anybody, or did you shut yourself off to that? How does that work?
Oh yeah, I did. I tried not to, but there was actually someone. I decided I was retiring properly when I started my degree.
Yeah,
and I had this like account on this website I used to work off. That kind of like semi kept. I don't really know. I'm not gonna like delve into myself like why I kept this account. But there was one client I kept thinking of who I used to see whenever he was in London, like once every month or two over the course of about 4 years. And I had clients that I'd been seeing for my longest term regular. I'd been seeing from 2014 until last September was the last one I saw. So like you do see people for a long time and like regularly, but this one, like I sent him a message just to say like bye, even I hadn't seen him in a couple of years. And then he sent me one back and I was like crying over it. And then I said everything makes me cry, but it was like this person was a part of my life and I actually genuinely liked them. There are a few like that. And then I also like, I've made the mistake of like dating a client before, which is always a mistake.
Some pitfalls.
That's me being harsh. I think people have had like successful relationships with clients, but it's There's so much extra stuff. There's like weird baggage with it.
Of course.
But yeah, you do, like, even if you don't want to, I think you do. I would say I hated most of my clients, but you do make human connections with them.
Yeah, because that's I wanted to know the answer to that, because people's assumptions about that industry is that it's purely about sex and physical needs of people that are perhaps not getting elsewhere, or they want to do things that they can't do with their partners or whatever it might be. And you never assume that there's an emotional contact. And if there was someone, then you'd assume that it would be a client becoming infatuated, or probably to a less extent just interested, like maybe in their brains they think that they love. But from the other perspective, it's still two human beings doing something that is even partly personal. It's an intimate act, even if it is a transaction.
Like, I mean, I think from their perspective, it's a bit different as well, because like almost every escort I know has a persona. I was pretending to be doing an undergrad degree when I was working, and like I had her and I had me, who were two separate people. There is some, like, maybe a bit of protection, where, like, if I'm acting in this role, I can just be whoever I want, so I would just, like, fucking say stuff all the time. And it, you know, they can't chase you up on it, and I think they do have an implicit understanding that it's not real. But some of them will, I've had, like, a regular propose to me before, so I think he probably thought it was real. But
Did you have to have that conversation with him to say, "Oh no, this isn't real," or how did you
no,
deal with that
I told him
situation? Brilliant. Sorry, I'm married. How did he take that?
I think he respected it because it was
He
another
understood.
man. He was like, "Oh, it's another man, so I'm not going to go on his turf."
Oh dear.
But yeah, like,
What's
yeah, it's sort
your
of.
Well, no, sorry, I wouldn't cut. Go on. I didn't want to cut you. I
Oh, I was
just
actually just gonna say, it's real and not real at the same time.
yeah. What's your opinion of men?
Oh, I'm not as. So I've gone through periods of sort of aggressive feminist man-hating in the past, but I don't think that had much to do with the work I was doing. I think it had more to do with the, like, being in my early 20s and using Tumblr and, like, having these, like, really bad politics that came with that. But,
Sorry,
like,
you mean like
now,
the echo chambers of Tumblr,
yeah, like the, like, hor like the sort of very bad woke nonsensical politics. But I'd say, like, I think coming out of the industry, and, like, I haven't done a booking in, I think, 7 months now. I have a, like, I think a bit more sympathy for clients, and a bit more sympathy about, you know, people being lonely and seeking connection. And I still think it's like I think it's not a good thing to pay for sex. But it's complex, and I've been thinking more about, like, I know, like, incel culture as well, and it's easy to blame a nameless, faceless man for, you know, politics or actions. And I don't mean like the incels who are, like, going around shooting people. I just mean, like, men who are frustrated that they aren't can't have sex.
Yeah.
I think it's easy to, like, look at them and not try and engage with maybe what they're dealing with, or, like, why things are difficult for them.
Yeah,
It's
100%.
easy just to be, I was like,
Well, it's just that there's always a why for why someone is the way they are, and they're not typically born into that political ideal or their opinion of women. In terms of talking about incels, that's not to say what they're doing isn't hugely damaging and problematic. It's just there's always a reason why someone is and behaves the way they do. And
yeah. And just, like, yelling, "Be nice to women," is it going to fix any of the, like, maybe the structural stuff that they're dealing with? Or, like, the, like, I like, I know, I use, well, I've deleted them now, but I use, like, the online dating apps and stuff. And, like, being a woman and being a man is very different on there. But, like, yeah, I guess to go back to, like, the sex work stuff, you don't really know what people's motivations are for paying for sex, and you don't know how the, you know, there's maybe like the more radical feminist idea is like it's all abuse, and it's not really, like, it's often unpleasant, it's often not very nice, but it's not inherently abusive. But yeah, so like men in general, I think it's everyone is like too complex and too individual for me to like hate men as a class, or like to find them frustrating as a class or whatever, because like everyone's just going through their own shit.
I think it's probably unfair of me to ask that question, because
it's something I've thought about a lot, like, and I think it's a natural question to ask.
Yeah, it's just that you assume, given the amount of men that you've had experiences with, that largely your feeling towards them would be negative, because that's the assumption and that's the stereotype. But I agree, there's a wide, broad church of reasons why.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
People would seek out a sex worker. Did you ever get approached by women? Did that ever happen?
I saw a lot of couples, because I marketed as like, but I am bisexual, I marketed as such. So yeah, I probably just saw like a few dozen couples. And
did
I
you
had
feel safe
to...
for doing that?
Yeah, I guess so. Like, I don't think you would think it would go like you don't feel like necessarily you're in physical danger in, if there's a woman present. But sometimes like their couple dynamics are like a whole other minefield to deal with, and it's mentally it's a lot more taxing sometimes, unless they're like both very secure in it.
What do you mean?
Oh, like I've had there was one that's just come to mind where the woman didn't speak any English, and the guy also didn't tell me that it was a couple booking, he just booked for himself. So he came in, I tried to close the door behind him, and this like woman comes in, and I'm just like,
wow.
Okay. And then I tried to talk to her, but she didn't speak any English, so she was like talking to him and he was translating. But they like also seemed, so they were like a Muslim couple as well. I think she was like, they were both from Pakistan.
Right.
And she seemed like she was having a great time, and I was just like, okay, I guess I feel odd that I can't communicate with her, and like maybe she feels odd that she doesn't understand what I'm saying, but I guess it's working. But then the bad ones were like, you'd have a couple who, you know, born and raised here, whatever. But it would be really obvious, like, it was the guy's idea.
Oh.
And she wouldn't be so happy with it. And you'd have to navigate this. Because generally, I will probably, like, take the woman's side in this.
Oh,
so,
yeah,
like,
naturally,
I'd be navigating it so she's, like, having less of a shit time. Or if he goes to the bathroom, you know, just check up on her and see if she's okay. But yeah, so that's its whole thing. But then I also had two female clients who just saw me by themselves, which is pretty small amount considering it was over 2,000 clients in general.
Yeah. And obviously not something you'd assume women would do. Stereotypically, you know, if you're just looking at if you're looking at society, you just assume it's all going to be men. So 7 months ago, how are you feeling about it now? Like, what do you feel like you're out? You're out, and that's it, or is it?
I nearly did a booking the other day, but that's I had some like other reasons for that, not like money reasons. That I think I was just feeling a bit sad about something, and someone offered a booking to me, and it was a lot of money. So I was like, you know what, I'm just gonna do it because I feel like shit. But thankfully, he's like cancelled. Otherwise, I probably would have done it. But
when you felt like shit, and this would get, what do you mean, like what I don't want you to look too far into yourself, and that's not again what this is about, but why would it make you feel
I think part of it was I felt I was just in a situation in my personal life that made me feel like unwanted and unattractive, and then was a booking, and that would have been a very short-term fix for that, and but also the money would have been nice. I want a student grant, but yeah, like I think it is, I still talk about sex work a lot from a political perspective, and because I did a lot of like activism before, and I'm not like entirely stopped, but I'm like also really aware that for sex work activism, or like generally workers' rights activism, you probably want people who are still in the industry to be doing it because they have, the stakes are higher for them. Like I can, if I'm getting involved in stuff, it doesn't necessarily affect me anymore. So I appreciate that maybe other workers wouldn't necessarily want me to be as engaged in the activism as I was before, but I still am like a little bit. I think it's always good to have bodies on the ground. But so it's still, I'm sorry.
What led you to the activism? What did you do there? Because it sounds like important work.
So I was always like very left wing. And I think the minute it clocked that I was a worker in a semi-criminalized workplace that wasn't unionized, it like made a lot of sense to me to like be like, well, maybe we should try and unionize, or like maybe we should. My main thing was our relationship with the police and the legality. I used to basically live in a brothel. I rented my room out. It was so expensive that I was like, you know, I'm just gonna live in here. Police.
Sorry, can I just take you back? So when you say this is a house in a street somewhere,
it was a flat in a.
In London,
I just want to like, yeah, I just want to. I kind of want to explain how it was, because it's a very 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 busy area of central London, right next to a tube station, in a flat in like zone one, so that's where it was. So like it's just like a try to maybe communicate that like you could be walking around anywhere in central London, and you it's like that thing about rats almost, like you're probably not that far from a working flat.
Really?
Yeah, like there are like, particularly in like bits of West London, are just like escorts working out of apartments or Airbnbs or flats everywhere.
So
but yes, so that, sorry.
No, go ahead.
Oh, just that flat was these like East End gangsters had subletted rented a load of flats, and were subletting them to escorts to use as brothels. And it was something insane. Like I was paying £550 a week for it. So I was like, screw it, I'm gonna live here. I didn't have a kitchen because they were subletting that as a room as well, or like a washing machine or whatever. But I was like, I'm paying this amount of money, I'm living here. So I was living in and seeing clients from the same like ensuite bedroom. And we got raided by police quite early on in that. And that made me, you know, I think when you're confronted with it, you become very aware that, like, oh yeah, this is a bit illegal.
Yes, but the legality for that is that you're essentially working. What? No, you tell me. What is the legality there? Why? When does selling your body be a legal thing to do that, and when does it become illegal?
So the act of selling sex, the act of buying sex, is completely legal. You know, so I could take money from someone and have sex with them, that's legal. But it becomes illegal when, so what we would have, if they had charged us or if they had arrested us, what it would be for would have been brothel keeping, because if you have a premises which could just mean an apartment where there is more than one person taking money for sex, that's a brothel, even if I'm not making money off the other girl, she's not making money off me. Like, if we do so much as like say if we see a client together, one of us takes the money and then we split it in the end, the act of some of me giving her money, even if it's her money, is would constitute me brothel keeping her. So that would be the illegal bit, which is pretty, it's like horrific, because it means that you can't have someone in the flat with you for safety. And there have been like cases where like cleaners have been taken to court and stuff because they're handling money and they're in the premises. It's very, very like stupid, nonsensical laws.
So when you said you were keeping it, you obviously made the logical decision to stay in a room and live in there because the money, it makes complete sense. But it must have been, was that not difficult because you couldn't leave the room where you had to see clients, that you had to live in that same room?
I had a bit of a mental breakdown. I had to like move back with my mum for a few months after.
I'm not surprised.
That
sounds like a difficult situation.
I think I probably would have tolerated, like, if I had a flat and I could, like, sleep in another bed or have somewhere to just leave that room. And then, and I'd be, like, sometimes seeing, like, 3 or 4 clients a day and you'd just be, like, in this room. And it was, like, it's, like, only one tiny window, so it's, like, not that ventilated. And you're just, like, oh, man, I don't like that this is my life right now.
No, I understand. Would you say that at any point during your career that you was wealthy?
Yeah, that year, that one year where I lived in that place, because of the location and because I was having to work a lot to compensate for the fact that I was paying like $550, a lot of money. That was the one time I hit like the other tax bracket. But then after that, I was just like, you know, I'm just going to like work to make rent and have money to live off. I don't want to like overdo it anymore, which sucked when it came to COVID and I had no savings.
Yeah. What did you do? I mean, it's not like you can apply for a small business loan or a bounce back loan, is it?
Yeah, I just went on like the dole, but I was subletting my place. So I couldn't get my rent covered and it was just like horrific. It was just really bad. That's why I made the decision to be like, okay, I'm going to go to university.
It must have been hugely difficult. But do you feel like it's a positive thing that you're leaving that part of your life?
Ended up, so a lot of maybe all the stuff that I dealt with, and you're like, I mean, I'm using a lot of like terrible metaphors, but it almost felt like I was like a shark and I just kept moving. And then COVID happened and I stopped moving. And then I was like, oh, wow, I've been putting my body on and my brain under a lot of stress the last few years. And a lot of maybe like not great stuff has happened that I've not let myself deal with, which has culminated in like me getting diagnosed with PTSD.
Do you know, I mean, you're laughing and I understand why, because you know, it can be a reaction to something significant, but and PTSD isn't a joke either, is it? And if you have been diagnosed with that, you're that's something that's incredibly difficult to deal with. But I'm trying to, as I talk to you, visualize your life, and I'm struggling to understand in the severity and the extremity of some of the situations that you've got yourself in, because you can only really truly understand it if you live through it.
Yeah.
And so it doesn't surprise me that you've come away from this with things that you have to deal with.
Yeah, like, I mean, I think people could probably fill in their own gaps when I say like bad things happen.
100%, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I think like bodies can like act like sponges. Sponges. I'm doing those bad metaphors again, but like,
that's so
I mean, well, the sponge can take so much water, right?
Yeah. That's good.
Oh no, my therapist actually said it's like you've got a drawer full of junk, and you get to a point where you cannot fit anything else in the drawer, and then you take everything out the drawer, and it's a mess, and you've got to sort through all the mess. I think that's kind of how she explained PTSD to me, because I was like not really understanding what it was. But it doesn't feel like a lot until you like sit with it, and then you're like, oh wow, that's like all of that stuff happened.
Yeah, you're resilient, and yeah, but you go through things, and the human body and its mind is an incredible thing. But there's only so much, and often when you're going through things, you can kind of compartmentalize a difficult period, and then when you look back at it and go, fucking hell, that was a lot.
Well, I mean, PTSD is your brain doesn't do the compartmentalizing, so you can't. It's not even like you go back and think about it. It sort of just pops back into your brain sometimes. And then that's what, you know, when you get triggered, or you have the stuff that stops you from living your life. It's because your brain is just refusing to compartmentalize it. And then it stops you from like processing memories in the future. It's all weird.
Do you find that when you're it'll be right when you say triggered, is it like watching things on telly and things will pop up, or conversations and it brings it back? Or are you comfortable talking
about it? Yeah, I can talk about it. Like, I don't know if it's derailing from like what we want to talk about, but
no, it's fine. Okay. As long as you're comfortable with it.
I'm fine. If ever, I'll just tell you.
Yeah.
But I have some visual triggers, some like scent ones. I only realized one not that long ago, where I was walking to my grandparents in like Leicester, and I went past a mosque on the way to on my dad's side, and then stuff came back, and I was like, oh right, because we'd always drive past this mosque to go to that side's house. That's a mental association I had, and my brain has like now decided to like fling a memory back at me. Like it can be stuff that you don't even realize that it is.
Yeah.
So
it can be a bit of a minefield, I guess, some days.
Yeah. So like, you know, I managed to get therapy for it, and it's all about like trying to work out like how do you, I think most people like need this anyway, like PTSD or not, but like your brain's throwing something at you. How do you deal with it to mean that you can just do the rest of your day?
I mean, obviously we've lived different lives, but as you're saying that, there are things that my brain was doing to me rather than I'm wanting them to happen. But there's been instances in the past where for some reason I cannot get my brain past this issue, and it's causing me severe discomfort and unhappiness, and I just cannot get past it. No matter, I didn't know how to deal with it or how to fix that situation. And I got some therapy for it, and after a few sessions, it fixed it. And now, when I think about that instance, it does not impact me emotionally at all. Like, I'm really lucky that I was really receptive to this form of therapy, but it does not. It's not there anymore. Whereas before, it was so there. I don't know if that's a good way to describe it. It's just there.
No, I get exactly what you mean. We're still like trying to find the right way for me to do it. Like, I've got it's like people have grounding objects, like something that you can just like have in your handbag, and you touch it and you feel the texture and you focus on the color or the smell of it or whatever. But like there are loads of different ways that you can get rid of the intrusive thoughts or the manage whatever it is.
Yeah. So what what led you to your university course?
So I needed to do a foundation. I always knew I wanted to do some kind of social sciences. Yeah. So my current course, I just applied for all of the ones that had a foundation year and somehow got into Durham without like proper GCSEs. Well, not GCSEs. Oh, I don't really have GCSEs, but I also don't really have like A-levels. But like, thankfully, they just like let me in.
Your class is a mature student, right? So when you go in, they you're looked at in completely different way, I think. I actually think university happens a little bit too early. I think so too. Yeah.
Like, did you go?
Yeah, I went to university. I did journalism in down in Falmouth. But okay. I did 2.5 years and I dropped out in the third year. I didn't really enjoy it. I enjoyed the social aspect to it, but I was also in a relationship, long distance relationship at the time. So it wasn't ideal at all. And then halfway through the third year, for reasons I won't go into, but it was impossible for me to stay there. So I just walked away with huge debt, no degree. And I reckon if I'd done it 10 years later, I would have got a lot out of it. But all of that is everything that happens is leads you to who you are right now, right? So I'm not resentful of it. But I think you're just more capable of applying. Well, certainly I was more capable of applying myself 10 years on than I would when I was when in my 20s or early 20s, for that matter. So yeah. what is it about? How do you see your next sort of few years and sort of getting a degree and moving on to a degree? And what is it that you have you had any thoughts about your future?
Yeah, so I was picking the degree and stuff with the the idea with it completely in mind that I'm doing this to get a job at the end of it. So I probably would have wanted to do a philosophy degree. Oh yeah, no shade at people doing philosophy done philosophy degrees, but I was like, I want a more direct career route.
They're expensive, so, with no guarantee, are they?
So my part of the activism stuff I was doing was when I had stopped doing public speaking for it because I just decided I didn't like doing it anymore. I moved to more backroom stuff. So I was with some of the orgs I was working with, I would just be doing research on from papers and just putting leaflets together from research from the papers or, looking up stuff the government had released and trying to work out how that would affect sex workers. So
I feel like we've actually skimmed over that, which is quite interesting. What did your activism look like? What were you doing day to day?
It was pretty sporadic, but at the beginning, I think there was an element of, if you look at me, I'm not what you would expect, someone who calls himself an escort to look like, which I think, and the sex work activism does have a reputation as being something that the rich girls do. And of course they want to keep their jobs safe because they're making loads of money. Whereas you look at me and you're this is a short, chubby Indian woman who isn't super posh and doesn't have a degree or whatever. It's just someone who just wants to work and live. So I think there's a better, people are better receptive to it if it's me talking. And this if I wanted to be cynical, I would say it's tokenizing, but I think it's a good sort of activist move. And there was one time I shared a space with a transgender man and someone who had substance abuse issues. And, this is the front of people you want to be talking about workers' rights because they are maybe the more marginalised workers.
The ones that are going to be most impacted by...
Yeah, there's one org who would always want to have a single mother on the panel because... For me, I think those, if you're looking at sex work law, the first people you should be looking at are migrants and single mothers, because those are the people who are generally pushed into it out of less choice.
Yeah.
So I was doing public speaking. I did a debate at Amnesty International once. That was horrible.
What was it? You was debating someone?
So Amnesty International as an international organisation had decided to support the decriminalisation of the sex industry, which is what we want, in 2015. And they put together this really amazing bit of research. They'd gone to Norway, who have client criminalisation, and actually talked to migrant workers who are being harassed by the police and stuff. And really good bit of research. And then 2 years later, the UK Amnesty, a group, tried to repeal that sort of vote. So we kind of, a group of sort of haphazard sex workers scuttled over to Nottingham or wherever it was and did a debate. So before the members voted, and thank God, we thrashed them. But it was just they called us pimps. They, the woman who came up after me was like, you're not going to see any women of color on the stage, but I'd literally just gotten off it. And I'm like,
wow,
quite dark skinned. Like, you could definitely tell a woman of color. It was just like a nightmare. It was like a lot of the stuff just wasn't rooted in reality as well. And I think because these people don't know sex workers, they just have their sort of ideological
Sort of conservative right?
No, they were like radical feminists.
Right. I'll get you. I understand.
Yeah. So they've become, I think, the same with like maybe the sort of fight about transgender people. There's the conservative right have sort of understood that their brand is toxic. So they let the feminists do the work for them.
That's strange, isn't it? It's a weird irony that the feminists who would not associate with the conservative right then are kind of doing their bidding.
Yeah. You see them like interacting with, like, and sharing money with people who want to get rid of abortion. It's like, okay, I guess you've picked your fight. But anyway, I'll go.
Politicking, isn't it? That's
yeah. But I'd also do like panels at universities that you just go and talk, usually to the Feminist Society, because they'll invite you along. But I think we've had, that was something else. And then we also, back when, like in the Corbyn years, Momentum groups would be voting on whether they would want to support decriminalisation or not. So they'd invite us along to give a talk and try and explain why it's a good idea before they'd have their vote. I know people who do loads of work involved with like Labour Party as well, trying to get them to adopt a decriminalisation motion to go through to the party to make them like adopt an actual position. But then when I got sick of the talking stuff, I would either do the research I was telling you about, or would say and advocacy. So there were, if someone's having trouble with the council, like someone's kid's mobility vehicle was taken away, so, and she was a sex worker, so I would just like run the council and harass the council and try to get it back. Or if someone doesn't speak.
It was like an unofficial union that you helped them.
We have unionized now. We're part of two different ones.
What are they?
So there is United Sex Workers who are part of UVW, sorry, and there is a sex work union part of GMB. And there's probably more, but like the strippers have got their own union as well. Mm. But before it was kind of the work of like organizations. So there's like English Literature Prostitutes and Sex Workers Advocacy and Resistance Movement all do good work. Like Swarm at the beginning of COVID fundraised a huge amount of money for sex workers, because we're like left overnight from lockdown with like no money, like no income. People have kids to feed, people have rent to pay. So they fundraised like a massive amount of money and dispersed it among sex workers, which, you know, the people who are trying to take our jobs, or I say are, not mine anymore, but the people who are trying to take those jobs away don't think about that. They're like, okay, you suddenly leave someone destitute, what are you going to do about it? It's nice that they're, you know, whatever, they're not doing the thing that you find distasteful anymore or that you think is abusive, but how are they going to feed their kids? And it doesn't really get talked about.
I wonder, do you feel like it is abusive, or is it empowering to women? What is it?
I don't think it's empowering. I don't think any job is empowering. I think we're all. I mean, this is me coming from like being a very grumpy socialist.
Yeah.
Like we have to work to pay someone else's mortgage, or the cost of living is going up, and our wages aren't, and you know all this stuff. I don't think earning money to live is empowering, not anywhere. But I also don't think I don't think paying for sex is inherently abusive. I think there are a lot of people who, including me, who have trauma from it. But if you say that every booking is abusive, you take my power away from me to say I have trauma from this instance. This thing was rape. You can't say that. So that was probably quite an aggressive way to say it. But like that, you know, say I'd say seeing four clients in one day. Three of them, whatever, forgot about them the day after. One of them assaults you. Not all those four things aren't the same. Like, the one is definitely, you have to be able to identify that this was the thing that was that was terrible, and I need to know how to sort this in my brain. Otherwise, yeah, if you say it's binary, all abuse, yeah. Then yeah, it's all shades of whatever. Like, yeah. I've had a guy, like, I was planning to do a philosophy degree. I had a guy turn up and just try to talk to me about philosophy for an hour. Like,
well, that's what his thing was.
I have the feeling he just turned up and didn't fancy me and he didn't want to waste his money. but yeah, like, there's a whole range of, you know, like, I had...
So he could have gone in and say, actually, no, this isn't right. I'm walking away. Or, and I'm presuming that you would find that, I don't know how you'd feel about that, actually, like, if someone turned up and thought no, but you think that he was too polite to do that, so he just talked to you about philosophy.
I don't know.
So English. That's such an English thing to do, isn't it?
I know, but you would get guys who turn up, they kind of look at you and they go, oh, I forgot my wallet in the car, and they never come back.
Right.
So there are, that's generally what happens if a client doesn't fancy the worker. Or if you get guys who just want to, like, who have made, have not an exhibitionist one, the other opposite one, where they just want to, like, come in and have a look at the flat and, like, have a look at the girl, and then they just go. But yeah, there's all sorts of, like, dumb stuff like that. But yeah, like, there was one guy who I just, like, put stuff up his butt for an hour. Like, completely.
So just that was it?
I mean, the stuff came out the butt, obviously, but, like, just putting stuff up there.
And, that was just his thing.
Yeah. I mean, good for him, I guess.
Fair play. If you found a way to, you know, do it and no one's getting harmed out of it, then yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, like, just make sure you sort of put it in a condom so you yank it out again, because I'm not taking them to A&E.
Good to know. I'll bear that in mind next time.
you can't say it's... Yeah, it's. I think it's ridiculous to say it's all abuse, because it's not, like... Some is definitely...
Nikita, I just want to give you, because I feel like we've come to the end, but I don't want to take away an opportunity to, if there's anything you want to say that you haven't had the opportunity to, but if there isn't, then I feel like we've reached the end of the conversation.
Yeah, I think we're good.
Okay, good stuff. Thank you so much.
Thank you for
speaking and being so open and stuff. And that's what this series is about. It's talking to people who've led lives that aren't typical, and that you can't... There's assumptions can never be made, and it's really important to just talk to people rather than have cast iron ideas about what a person is or because of a label that's been placed on them. Yeah. Thank you so much, Nikita.
Okay, cheers.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
This Mother's Day, treat mom to healthy, glowing skin with Osea's limited edition skincare sets. Osea has been making clean, seaweed-infused products for nearly 30 years. Their advanced eye care duo brightens and firms skin around your eyes, while the Golden Glow Body Trio nourishes and smooths skin all over. Go to oseamalibu.com and use code MOM for 10% off your first order site-wide.